tell her. But what I say is, I'm going. I'm going. She runs her hand down my shirt. I'll miss you. But you know that. Ask me to stay. I want to respond. Ask me to stay and I will. I have no more willpower with you. If you ask me to stay, I won't go. I'll miss you more than you can know. She shakes her head, swallowing hard. Go. You'll tempt me to steal you. Steal me. I'll steal you too. The words echo through my mind, but don't make it to my lips. But I know you need to go. You need to do this. Do it, then come find me. She offers a faint smile on those last words, and I want to hold on to them for as long as I can. I will. I kiss her one more time, and then before either one of us can stop this, I walk away. I don't know if I will find her. I don't know if she'll want me to, or if she'll have moved to her new life in Texas with some cowboy or oil tycoon. But I can't linger on that. I have a promise to keep. A promise that I won't hold her back. An hour later, I board my flight, and as the jetliner arises in the sky, I close the shade, shut my eyes, and try in vain to blot out the regret.
Chapter 31. Joy. It would be a bald-faced, big-ass lie if I looked in the mirror and said my eyes looked great. Today, they most decidedly do not. But that's what makeup is for, to cover the tears I shed on my rooftop last night. Of course I cried. Fat, salty tears. Of course I'm sad, like someone punched a hole in my heart. Of course I need Jackie O sunglasses today. And yet, I'm not miserable. I'm not devastated. I've had enough time to cry. I've been processing the end of us since we began. We fell in love while we were breaking apart. We were simultaneously coming and going. Maybe when you live through a bittersweet love, it makes the ending easier. As Elise would say, some relationships only last for the blink of an eye, but that doesn't make them any less worthwhile. It was worth it. Every moment was worth it. And now it's Sunday evening, and I'm hungry. I leave, and once I reach the street, I ask my friend a question. Google, where is the nearest brasserie with excellent salads?
The nearest brasserie with excellent salads is on Rue Jacob.
Thank you, I say to my phone after we finish conversing in this country's native tongue. I changed the settings recently. I no longer speak to Google in English. I talk to her in French, and she answers me in that language. It's our little bond, like a shrink-patient privilege. I turn down the block following her directions and find she's taking me to one of the passages, a covered arcade. Mosaic tiles line the floor. The archways high above span two or three stories, and as I turn down the hall, I pass a shop peddling old-fashioned wooden toys, a bookstore with arty titles, and a shop selling maps. I'm a digital woman. I don't want a map to pin to my wall or a globe to spin. But as I gaze at a blue orb in the window, staring at the distance between Paris and Bali, I'm keenly aware of how big our world is. And how very small, too. The world is a massive place that can swallow you whole. Or you can embrace its vastness, right along with little provincial joys, like dinner at a fine cafe. As I take a seat at the table, glancing at the empty chair across from me, I wait for the tears to lock up my throat. I steel myself for the vise in my chest, squeezing my heart. But when the waiter arrives and asks me what I want to drink, I've no time to mourn. I have to order, and I no longer have a safety net. I ask what the specials are. He tells me. I ask how the chicken is prepared. I'm informed. And then I order a wine and a salad with sliced chicken. When the wine arrives, I thank him and take a drink. I watch as couples stroll along the tiled floor, as mothers hold hands with daughters, as groups of friends scurry in search of a drink. Once my food arrives, I take a photo and post it to my feed,
Hashtag dinner in the city of lights. Hashtag ooh la la. Hashtag bon appetit. I want to remember this night. I want to look at this photo and recall how I feel right now. The sadness that lingers along with the happiness I was lucky enough to experience before I said goodbye to him. And even though I'm alone, I don't feel lonely. Not as I eat, not as I walk down the street to my flat later that night, and not as I head into work the next day, saying hello to my colleagues, and for the most part, managing to talk to them in their language. It's not perfect, I'm not fluent, but I'm good enough to get by now. After work, I stop by the market to pick up some fruit, and as I head down the stalls, a gray-haired woman asks if I dropped a scarf. She points to a sky-blue silky scrap on the ground. That's mine. Thank you so much. I pick it up and toss it around my neck, even though it's not cold. But it is fashionable, and for that reason alone, I adore this accessory. I head to the metro, navigating seamlessly. Later, after I climb the steps to my terrace, I drink in the city at my feet. I know. I've always known. I miss him fiercely. I miss him wildly. And I know what my heart wants. To have it all. I call Elise and ask for her help.
Chapter 32. Griffin. Sweat slicks down my chest. The sun fires bullets of heat. No relief is in sight. I long to tear away from the group of runners and dive into the endless blue sea temptingly nearby. In the first 10 days on the Indonesian island of Bali, I've already gone scuba diving, seen the waterfalls, and hiked up a mountain at dawn to view the sunrise. Each was enjoyable in its own way, and each was a little bit empty, too, because I did them alone. But every day I've run, and now, when it counts, I hit the 20-mile mark. My feet are screaming at me, shouting that they'll never permit this crap again. But even so, my heart is pounding strong and I never let up. I run through the sand, I run through the town, and I run while the sun bakes my shoulders. Another mile, another one more, and I'm nearly there. As the finish line looms into view, I expect to be clobbered with memories, with images of my brother. But those don't come. Maybe this makes me selfish, but I'm grinning and muttering. Holy crap, I'm doing it. I'm fulfilling the dream I had when I was younger. But life got in the way and I never got around to running a race. Now, I'm finishing a marathon. One foot in front of the other. Every footfall aches and every footfall sings. And when at last, more than a decade after I decided to do this, I cross the finish line, I punch the air. I let out a whoop. I feel like the most selfish prick in the world, but not for long, because it's too awesome a feeling to accomplish something I've always wanted to do. As I slow my pace, grab some water that a volunteer hands to me, and walk instead of run, my whole life comes into focus. Everything is bright and clear, the past and the future. Bali is but a whisper. Joy was right. Everything she told me on the train ride home from Giverny is true. Goosebumps rise on my skin with the staggering realization that the list was never about my brother.
Chapter 33. Joy. Christian slaps his hands together like a coach, rubbing one palm against the other.
Come on, you can do this, kid,
he says, adopting an American accent and smacking me on the arm. Elise rolls her eyes from her perch on her living room couch. It's 7:30 in the morning on a Monday, but they're prepping me one last time.
Oh, come on now, you're not her football coach.
He narrows his eyes.
You mean proper football, I trust. The world's greatest sport. Right?
Elise laughs. Joy is from Texas. I mean the one you despise. She turns to me. From the top.
I take a deep, calming breath. I square my shoulders. I practice once more what I want to say to Marisol when I meet with her in 2 more hours. My words aren't what I'd say if I had Griffin translating for me. I don't have him to rely on. I have to go it alone. I keep it simple so I can say it myself. When I'm done, they both slow clap. "You're ready," Elise declares. "Now go convince her to let you have it all." I show Marisol the tester bottle. "This is the perfume I made over the past 3 months. I want to introduce it here in France. I want to keep finding ways to bring innovation to L'Artisan. I want to introduce new products here and to help oversee them. If you'll have me, I want to stay. If you like this mix, I'll do everything I can to make it a success for you." Marisol blinks. "You want to stay?" She points to her desk. "Here, in Paris." Nerves fly up my throat. I want to stay so desperately. I came to Paris for a new experience, and that experience has changed me. I didn't just fall in love with Griffin. I fell in love with the city. I fell in love with a whole new language. Paris feels like home. I'm not done with Paris, and I hope Paris isn't done with me. Marisol squeals. It's the strangest sound from such a proper woman. But she actually squeaks, then rises from her chair in a flurry. She strides over to me and wraps me in an unexpected hug. "I accept the continuation of your employment." When it comes to chances that don't come around often, this is the one I'd most regret if I let it pass by. The chance to stay here. I don't doubt that it would be wonderful to run a perfume lab in Austin, but here in front of me, I can keep learning a whole new language, a whole new way of living. I might not be overseeing a fleet of scents, but if I can guide one to market, it'll be more than a dream come true. She dangles the glass bottle between 2 fingers. "By the way, do you have a name for your composition?" "I have a name, and I have a story. It is all my bittersweet days when I wander across the cobblestone streets, damp with rain. It is the sweet floral mists from the flower market that enchant my senses. It is the chocolate notes that waft through the air at a shop that's close to heaven. It's the smell of the first kiss and a last kiss. It is the promise that somehow, someday, we will meet again. For now, I'm calling it Come What May." She nods and smiles. "I like that. It's both sad and happy at the same time, but it ends on a dash of hope." "Yes, that sounds like exactly what it is." When I leave the office that night, return to my street, open the pink door and climb the uneven 84 steps, I know what the woman in the pink checkered suit on the plane told me has come true. Paris is where you go to reinvent yourself.
Chapter 34. Griffin. Sometimes something is so obvious, you're not sure how you missed it. But that's because it was hidden in plain sight. Like all those damned angels that followed me around the city while I never noticed them. That evening, I dig my toes into the coolest sand, the ocean lapping at my feet. As I watch the stars winking in the sky, I read between the lines on the list I memorized long ago. 10 items and a postscript. A bucket list. A dying wish. But it's not that at all, it turns out. Joy unlocked the code before I did. She discovered the real meaning, but I wasn't ready to hear it. I dismissed her theory, stuffing it away. It took running 26 miles halfway around the world to see that it was never a bucket list I carried with me. It was instructions for living. For how to live without him. Ethan didn't ask me to complete those 10 items. He only gave me this list when I told him I'd do anything for him, when I begged him for it. He looked at me, studied my eyes and knew what I needed. Something to live for. Reasons to be happy without him.
Okay. Let's do it. One last list.
It was a list for me. A list of all my hopes and dreams. It was guidelines on how to live a rich and beautiful life. He wrote me a treasure map for how to make it through his death. He was so clever, even up to the end. He knew I'd need a nudge, so my dreams were veiled in the guise of his dying wishes. I'm the one who wanted to run a marathon. He'd already completed one. I'm the one who longed to live in Paris, and he made sure I did it. He told me to travel the world because I'd led the charge in planning our adventures when we were kids. He knew I'd want to laugh with friends, so he put the caricature item on the list. He knew I'd want to help others, so he put that on the rules to live by too. I have lived most of these 10 wishes, but I don't want to live all of them anymore. I'm not consumed with the same clawing need to visit all the corners of the world anymore. I no longer suffer from an incurable case of wanderlust. I've been cured. I've uncovered a new dream right before my eyes. I have a new wish. To be with the woman I love, wherever she is. I wanted her to ask me to stay, but that's not enough. I need to put my heart on the line for her. She never held me back from going, and I won't hold myself back any longer. If she's going to be in Texas, that's where I'll go. But there's one more thing on the list that I need to fulfill. I need to take a chance that terrifies me. I thought I'd done that. I thought that pursuing joy counted. But even when I crossed it off, it never fit because wanting to be with joy never terrified me. The true risk is letting go of this list and flying without an instruction manual. Navigating without a map. But the time has come to find my own way. I raise an imaginary glass like I did when I said goodbye to Paris, but now I'm saying goodbye to the man I was. A man motivated by a promise, driven by the past. It's time to choose something entirely new, something no one wrote down, but it's what I want most in the world. Now, I need to figure out how quickly I can get to Texas.
Chapter 35. Joy. Lest anyone think I'm just a lush who loves the vino, let the record reflect that I do consume my morning fuel roofside too. I bring the ceramic mug to my lips and down some of the life-sustaining beverage as I watch the city wake up. Boats glide along the water, and the morning mist burns away from the tower. I glance at my phone. I'm due at the office in an hour, and I need to make it on time. I head to the stairs, stopping briefly at the chaise. Images flash and pop of all the dirty deeds this chair has witnessed. "Oh, the stories you could tell," I say in a flirty whisper, bending down to kiss the top of the pillow as I pretend the chair can talk. A piece of paper catches my eye. Tilting my head, I study the corner of a flowered card poking out from beneath the lounge. I reach underneath and find the card Griffin gave me when he invited me to Giverny for the weekend. Did I leave it here on the roof that night when he asked me to go? I suppose it's possible. I pick it up and head down the steps, flicking it open when I reach the living room. I stumble and grab hold of the railing, gasping as I read. Words that shock me. Words that aren't an invitation to Giverny at all. This is another card entirely. Maybe it fell out of his pocket? Maybe he always intended for me to discover it. Or was it never meant to be seen? I run my finger over the blue ink of his handwriting. "A part of me wants to stay with you. A part of me wants you to ask me to. If you did, I'd do it. Cancel the trip, curl up with you, and be happier than I've ever been before. That's how I am with you. And another piece of me wants to steal you away with me so we can be together,
It feels impossible, but it also doesn't. Say I'm not crazy. My heart hammers against my ribcage. It rattles the bars. It jumps and bangs, begging me to listen. He wanted to stay with me before he knew about my job offer. He wanted to stay even after he learned of it. As I flash back to the night after my dinner with Marisol, I recall his face perfectly, the sadness in his eyes, the thickness in his voice. "I don't want to hold you back," he'd told me. "How would you hold me back? You won't even be here," I'd said. When he didn't answer, I'd pushed back. "You won't be here, right?" I remember hoping, wishing his mind had changed. Had it already? Had he planned to cancel his trip, but then stopped when he learned of my job offer? My heart is a cyclone of emotions. It spins and whips, and there's only one thing to do. Run to the computer, tell him, take a chance, bring him home. Scrambling to my laptop, I flip it open, find his email, and tap out a message. Subject line, "You're not crazy." On the terrace, I found a card you never gave me. It made me fall a little bit more for you, if that's even possible. But it is, and that reminds me that I don't think we're impossible at all. I'm still here. I'll be here. I'll be waiting for you. Joy. He doesn't reply. For a minute, then another 5 minutes, 10 godforsaken minutes later, my inbox is still stupidly empty. It doesn't replenish itself in the next 20 minutes with anything but offers for coupons and news of shoe sales while I finish getting ready and head to work. At the office, it's radio silent. By noon, I've nearly worn out the fingerprint on my index finger from hitting refresh constantly. Still no reply. Not a word, not a peep. By the end of the day, my nerves are frayed thin, my emotions strung tight, and my sister is surely spent from replying to messages from me all day long, even though it's 7 hours earlier where she is. I grant her a reprieve from man talk. Joy. Enough about boys. When will you come visit me? The French fries here are even better. Allison. French fries. Snort. I should hope so. Answer the question.
When you invite me.
You're invited. Catch the next plane.
How about next month instead?
Deal.
Also, please arrange numerous dates with hot Frenchmen for us.
But I won't be riding shotgun on that request. There's only one hot Frenchman I want, and he's British, too. I set my phone down and return to my work. Charles helps me with the final formulations for Come What May. We speak in a mix of French and English, and we've finally figured out how to communicate without burning down the lab. When I leave that evening, I nearly rip my phone from my purse to check it again. Outside the building, I smack into Elise.
You're stalking me? I tease.
I am. Now, I want you to go home, put on a pretty dress, and wear your finest shoes, because I'm taking you out tonight to celebrate.
You could have called and told me that.
She links her arm with mine while I steal a glance at my email. No replies.
I know, but that's not my way. I wanted to see your face.
I like your face, too.
Besides, it's my job to appear randomly to remind you why you stayed in Paris. Because you have friends here, and a rich and lovely life.
You're acting odd today.
I'm never odd.
She strolls home with me and we chat, catching up on her work and mine, then admiring displays in windows, pointing out where we want to eat the next weekend. I ask her about Christian and whether she's ever going to tell me if there's something going on between them. She winks.
Maybe. Maybe there is.
But we've reached my home. Do you want to come upstairs and wait? She shakes her head and gives me a kiss on each cheek.
I'll wait for you at the cafe at the corner.
I walk upstairs, my head bent over the phone the whole time. It's been more than 11 hours. What on earth is Griffin doing? Ziplining with monkeys? Swimming with dolphins? Lolling on the beach with beautiful women in bikinis? I howl in jealousy at the thought.
20 minutes later, I text Elise that I'm on my way down. It's late June, and this peach sundress I put on is perfect for a night out with friends. Strappy sandals are on my feet, and summer is in the air when I push open the pink door. I stop in my tracks. All the breath in my body escapes me. My eyes are playing tricks on me, because this only happens in the movies.
Chapter 36. Griffin. I cross the street, wild excitement stirring inside me. It's the thrill of hope. It's the rush of a brand new start. It's everything I feel when I see her face, exuberance, desire, and this great and wild love. She stands dazed in front of her pink doorway, eyes wide open. My joy. Framed by the boldest of bold colors, just the way she likes it. A vision in peach and pink, and all that red spilling over her shoulders. When I reach her, I say two simple words. Bonsoir. Bonsoir. Comes out breathy, full of wonder. Her lips part as if she's trying to say more, but no words come. Instead, she raises her hand, tugs at my shirt, then flings her arms around me. I reciprocate, pulling her close. She melts against me and it feels spectacular. This is a welcome home, the likes of which men climb mountains for. I'm not sure what I did to deserve it, but as she draws her nose down my neck, inhaling me in the way that only she can, I know I'll take it. Every day. She lets her arms fall from me, places her hands on my chest, and looks in my eyes. Her gaze is curious, quizzical. Did you get my email? I nod. About an hour and a half ago, when I landed, there was no Wi-Fi on the 17-hour flight. Her brow furrows. Wait, what? You only got my email an hour ago and you're here? She points to the ground as if she needs to make sure I know where we are. But I know. Hell, do I ever know where I am and where I want to be. I was already on my way, I say, running a hand up her bare arm. I'm a starving man. I've gone too long without touching her. I need contact. Need to feel her skin. She shivers as my fingers reach her shoulder. I thought you were in Texas. I was sure you'd taken the job there, and I was about to buy a ticket all the way from Bali to Austin.
You were?
She whispers.
I was.
I was going to find you wherever you were.
In Texas?
You say that like it's the height of insanity. She shakes her head as if she's shaking off water.
I'm just surprised.
Joy, if you'd gone to Mount Everest, I'd have purchased a ticket there. If you were in the Arctic Circle, that's where I'd have travelled to. A grin crosses her lips and seems intent on staying there.
How do you wind up here, then?
I brush my fingers back down to her wrist. I figured it would be wiser to call a friend before I bought a ticket, so I rang Christian and he told me you'd decided to stay, so I came back.
Because of me?
Her voice wobbles. I thread my fingers through hers, clasping tight. She squeezes back.
Yes, because of you. It's all because of you.
You were right on the train, and I wasn't ready to hear it then. I had to fly 5,000 miles and run another 26 before I was whacked with the "it's so damn obvious" stick.
Did it hurt?
She asks playfully, and that pitch-perfect dry sense of humor is part and parcel of why I'd fly 5,000 miles again and again to see her. It felt good. Sometimes a man needs to be whacked with the sheer obviousness of his life. It was so crystal clear, and now I have a new list. Do you want to hear it?
I do.
I let go of her hand, take out a sheet of paper from my pocket, unfold it, and clear my throat. Five things I want to do. One, be with you. 2. Love you every day. 3. Give you heaps and heaps of screaming orgasms whenever you want. 4. Wander the world with you or just explore Paris together. Whatever the world is to you, I want to be by your side. 5. Drink champagne on your rooftop as we say goodbye to the crazy idea that we weren't meant to last. Because we are. P.S. This list also includes the ongoing, always and forevermore invitation to visit chocolate shops, bakeries, and any market you wish, whenever you wish, as well as more orgasms. P.P.S. Have I mentioned orgasms? She throws her arms around my neck once more.
I do believe you can have it all.
I arch an eyebrow. Are you saying you want to have your cake and eat it too?
Cake is always a good idea.
So is falling in love. So is staying in love. So is staying together. What do you say we do that? She quirks up her lips, and her bright green eyes twinkle with mischief. When she answers me, she's not speaking the language she knows best.
I'd say you have yourself a deal.
I cup her cheeks, hold her face and kiss her. Like that, we make the world disappear. It's us, kissing on the street, coming back together. Coming home. She's who I always want to return to, every night. When at last we pull apart, she's breathless and flushed. It's a look I like seeing on her. It's a look I want to make sure she always wears. She nibbles on one corner of her lips and glances at her watch.
Elise is waiting for me. I should go tell her you're having me for dinner.
I laugh. She already knows.
What?
I might have been impulsive in surprising you, but I'm not stupid. I called my mate, he called your friend, and they made sure you'd be home when I was arriving.
You clever man,
she says appreciatively, as she unlocks the pink door.
I guess she's not waiting for me at the cafe on the corner.
No, I don't think she is.
So, 17 hours on a plane,
she muses as she tugs me to the staircase.
You must be exhausted.
Yeah. I want to go to sleep straight away, I say dryly, since nothing could be further from the truth. I slept soundly on the plane. Any chance I could crash here? She laughs.
Yeah. Feel free to crash on my couch. I'll be quiet.
You've never been quiet, I say, and smack her ass as she heads up the stairs.
You're the one to blame for all my noise.
I'd like to always be the one to blame for that. Soon we're up all those damn stairs. The door bangs shut, and our hands grab at each other. I can't stop kissing her. Can't stop touching her.
I don't know how I thought I could do without you, I say. Don't then.
I push up her skirt, tug down her knickers and press her hard to the wall. In seconds, my jeans are undone, and I push in as her body welcomes me. I still when I'm inside her, letting the fantastic reality of my life set in. I'm back where I belong. A shudder racks my body as I start to move in her. She ropes her hands around my neck and pulls my face closer, kissing me the whole time. Her red lips never stop claiming mine, rough, fierce, demanding. I hike up her leg and wrap it around my hip, going deeper. She moans, loud and long, noisy, like she'd promised she'd be. She sounds like she's getting lost in us again. Like she did every time. Like I want her to do all the time. I want her to get lost with me, so I can be the one to find her. Soon she's trembling, and I watch as her pleasure moves through her, as she dissolves into my arms, and before I know it, I follow her there, and we come back together.
Thanks for the postscript,
she murmurs. I laugh as I tug her close. You always get the postscript. After another time, and yet another, we flop onto her couch, spent. She plays with my hair and my stomach growls.
You must be hungry, she says.
I lift up her skirt. Why, yes, let's do it again. She swats at me.
Hungry for dinner?
Sure. 15 minutes later, we're at the cafe around the corner where she orders for us, then sets down her menu.
So, you're back in Paris.
Did Sophie keep her place for you? I shake my head. She rented it. Joy taps her chin.
Interesting.
Is that interesting?
You've come back to Paris without a place to live. You must really like me.
I guess I do. It's going to be hard living on the streets, isn't it? So rough. But I'll make do.
I can toss you a blanket if you need.
Oh, please, don't put yourself out. I have a bench I plan to sleep under.
That sounds fabulous.
She spreads her napkin on her lap.
But just in case that doesn't work out.
You have something else in mind?
She shrugs as she smirks. I suppose you could live with me.
I reach for her hand. I would love to climb 84 steps every day and every night with you. She narrows her eyes, stares at me.
You're not going to run off to Iceland or Russia or the Amazon, are you?
I have everything I want right here in front of me.
Good, because I'm not going anywhere.
Turns out this city suits me. Suits you perfectly. She slides her hand across the table.
Stay with me.
I will. As we dine and talk and laugh, and then stroll back to our home, I'm aware every moment that this is exactly where I want to be. Here, now, and for always.
Epilogue. Joy. I wrap a ruby-red scarf tighter around my neck and pull a white knit cap over my red hair. December has arrived, bringing snowfalls, nights in front of the fireplace, and the endless need to warm up under the covers. Now, though, I'm venturing outdoors. Sometimes, on Saturday afternoons, I surprise Griffin. I like to show up on the tail end of his tours. He's still translating, but he's also doing something he loves even more. He's introducing tourists and natives alike to the curiosities of Paris that are hidden in plain sight. He's not operating boat rides along the Seine or leading trips through the Louvre. Others can do that better and enjoy it more, he has said. But there's no one, not a soul in the whole wide world, who knows the corners of Paris better than him. The spots with unexpected delights that can be found all over this metropolis. A few times a day, he'll guide travelers to the oddities of our city, showing them the street that runs under a residence in the 17th arrondissement, bizarre sculptures that jut out of buildings, sundials that do work, and sundials that don't do their jobs at all. At other times, he mixes up his repertoire and takes his customers on tours of the best chocolate shops, always ending at what I call heaven with a cup of hot chocolate. That was my idea. After all, who doesn't like chocolate? Sometimes he leads tours in Spanish, sometimes in French, often in English, and occasionally in Portuguese, since he now knows that language. That was his dream, and he stayed the course. Perhaps he was always meant to be an explorer. His journeys have simply become more local in the city we both now call home. But we've managed to break out our passports a few times in the last several months. We're not world travelers, but we saw the northern lights in Iceland, and they were as majestic as a queen's glittery crown. We flew to Copenhagen last month and wandered through the charming streets, and we're taking off for Tokyo in a few months to finally see what Griffin calls the Neon City. It's more fun going places with you, he'd said when we watched the stars in the cool night sky near the Arctic Circle. Everything's better together, I'd replied. Life has been good here, too. Come What May is rolling out in time for the Christmas season, and I'm hopeful it'll be a hit.
My sister and parents will be visiting for the holidays, and I plan to take them shopping at all my favorite outdoor markets and the most fantastic department stores, too. After that, Griffin and I will take the train to London to see his parents for New Year's. Really, what more could an American girl in Paris ask for? I'm speaking the language capably every day, mixing up concoctions in the lab during my working hours, and coming home to a man who makes me laugh, who makes me smile, and who loves to whisk me away. Sometimes we take a trip around the world and we don't even have to go anywhere. That's what making love with him feels like. I guess I've always been a goner for a man with an English accent. And now I get to listen to one pretty much whenever I want. Yes, that's what I call having it all. Today, I join in when he shows a group of Americans from San Francisco the angel I spotted in Île de la Cité one fine Sunday afternoon many months ago. "I'm not sure this angel means anything," he says, pointing to the cherub carved into stone above an awning. "But it means something to me. The woman I love noticed it one day when we ate ice cream and wandered these streets. I'd never seen it before, not in all my travels. I learned then that some things are right in front of us, and we just have to look up." He gives them all a few moments to look up, snap photos, then say goodbye. When they disperse, he takes my arm and links it through his. I ask how his day has been. "You tell me, you little spy." "I like to keep you on your toes with my random appearances." "And you do. You always do." I raise my face and meet his gaze. "What do you want to do tonight?" He narrows his brow as if considering my question. "Sip champagne on the rooftop?" "That's always a good idea," I say, as we stroll by the oldest clock in Paris. The golden hands tick-tock their way around the face. "That clock is when I knew I wanted to be with you," he says, a happily wistful tone to his voice. "It is?" He nods. "I remember thinking about time and how we can't ever retrieve lost hours, but we can make the most of the hours in front of us, and I wanted to spend those with you." It took me a while to sort out how that would happen, but now I have, and I want to keep savoring every minute. He takes a beat, snapping his fingers as if he's remembering something recently forgotten. "That reminds me, I had another idea for what to do tonight." "What's that?" He drops to one knee and flips open a maroon velvet box. My heart beats so loudly I can hear it, I swear, and a rush of breath escapes my lungs. Warmth spreads all over me as I gaze at a gorgeous diamond solitaire. "Let's get engaged tonight," he says, holding my gaze. "I love you madly, Joy. I love you so much I'd follow you around the world. I'd make you the center of my world. That's what you are to me. And as we've made new dreams together, I have one more. Item number 6. For you to be my wife." My smile is as wide as the river. I drop to my knees, throw my arms around his neck, and cry the happiest tears of my life. I murmur one word as my answer. "Oui." Fitting that it's the same sound as an English word I rather love. Oui. That's what we are.
Another epilogue. Griffin. 6 months later. The bubbly liquid slides down the crystal flute and I hand it to Joy, setting the bottle on the table. She raises her glass as the sunset flares behind her, the last remnants of the day tugging streaks of deep pink into the horizon. "And what are we toasting to tonight, Mr. Thomas?" I clink my glass to hers. Could it be that you now have 3 last names?" She leans her head back and laughs, a rich, bright laugh that I love. "Assuming I use them all." "Oh, please. What could be better than introducing yourself as Joy Danvers Lively Thomas, the best perfumer in the world?" That does have a nice ring to it, she says, taking a drink of the champagne. Speaking of rings, I hold up my hand, the platinum band on it sparkling under the fading light, then thread my fingers with hers. I take another drink, set the glass down, and pull her next to me on the chaise. That takes care of number 5 on my list. Drink champagne on your rooftop when we say goodbye to the crazy idea that we weren't meant to last. Because we are. Check. She brushes her lips to mine. Can I have my postscript now, please? You can always have that. And I make sure she always does. The end.
That concludes Wanderlust, and now we present a special interview with the author, Lauren Blakely. Lauren, how did you come up with the storyline for Wanderlust?
Well, it originated with the hero. That's where it all started. I wanted to write a British hero. I've written a couple in the past, but not recently. And this seemed like the perfect storyline for a British hero. And once I knew that I wanted to write a British hero, of course, audio is so important and so key to that. So I really kind of envisioned it from the get-go and kind of heard his accent right from the start. And that's what I started building the storyline around. It was, okay, this is my guy. This is who he is. And then I thought, oh, let's make it really magical and romantic and set it in Paris.
Wow.
And let's not give him a French heroine. Let's give him an American heroine, because I think that most of the readers will relate to that a little bit more. And I also then wanted to get that kind of fish out of water quality, that even though Griffin knows both languages and Joy doesn't, they both are these English speakers in this incredibly romantic place, but both sort of not entirely at home there.
And you went to Paris yourself to research Wanderlust. How did your travels inspire the story?
So I love Paris. I know, shocking. It's a wonderful place. I have been fortunate enough to have visited it many times. My most recent trip, which coincided with right when I started writing the story, I think was actually my 6th trip to Paris. And I feel very fortunate that I've been able to go there so many times. It's a place that I've visited in a few novels in the past. Listeners who are familiar with my work might have seen scenes set in Paris in Sinful Love and also in Caught Up in Us. But what I really wanted to do was immerse listeners in the city for the very first time, where the vast majority of it will take place in Paris. So when I was there wandering around the city, that's honestly where I draw the most inspiration. Because to me, it's the streets of Paris that are kind of magical. It's not just the Eiffel Tower, which is amazing, and it's lit up at night, and it's gorgeous, and it looks like jewels and gemstones and all of that. But it's just wandering down the streets where you see the beautiful French buildings and the ivy and the floor-to-ceiling windows and the shutters, and then these streets where some of them are cobbled, and then the awnings and these ironwork. And I just wanted readers to kind of feel what it's like, not just to see all of the places that we've heard about thousands of times in Paris, the Louvre, and so on, but my goal is for them to really feel like they're walking down the streets of Paris, because to me, that's where sort of the magic and the romance of the city happens. So when I look at some of the specifics in the storyline, for instance, Joy rents a flat that has a pink door, and that is a big reason why she rents it. And while I was there, I came across a pink door, and I just thought, that is the coolest thing. Like, you don't run into pink doors everywhere. You don't see them all over the place in America. And that's part of, I think, what makes that city stand out to me, is those sort of random things that you encounter. A door knocker that has an angel on it, you know, another door that's this bright shade of emerald, just walking down a street and seeing a perfume shop, you know, right next to a patisserie with these incredible looking cakes. And now I'm hungry and thinking of all these wonderful things that I want to eat. But that's what I wanted to really bring into the story. And my hope is that listeners feel like they're there. But the other thing that I really wanted to get at, because when I was there, I was thinking a lot about the language barriers, of course. I mean, that's always there. I speak just transactional French. I can accomplish ordering at a restaurant. I can buy a few things. And that's really sort of all I can do. And that's, of course, how Joy starts in the book. And I wanted to kind of capture what that feels like, where your ability to communicate is so halted and it's so kind of stop and start, because that's what it's like for most of us when we travel to a foreign country. So I hope that going there and experiencing that myself informs some of how she interacts through the city.
Wow. Well, thank you for taking us to Paris in this book. And you're a big audio fan yourself. Where do you find yourself listening to audiobooks most?
Mostly I listen to them when I walk my dogs, and I have four dogs. So I do spend a lot of time walking them, and that's helpful because that gives me time to listen to audiobooks. Sometimes I listen to them when I drive, but I'm not a commuter because I'm a writer. I work from home, so my drives tend to be very short, you know, running errands. And I actually can't quite get into audiobooks as much on the 5-minute drive. So I do listen to them mostly when I'm out walking my dog. And there have been times, walking my dogs, I should say, and there have been times where, you know, I have my earbuds in and I have two dogs or four dogs, depending on how many I ventured out with for that particular walk. And I'm just cracking up. You know, I'm listen to something funny in The Martian, or I listen to, you know, something funny in L. Kennedy, Serena Bowen novel that I've been listening to. So yeah, I'm that person who's kind of cracking up while I'm listening to the audiobook, walking my dogs.
And if you weren't a writer, what would your backup career be?
I wanted to be a Broadway star. That was my goal. I wanted to sing and dance on Broadway. And there are actually only a few things that got in the way of that dream. And one is I can't sing. I also can't act. And the third one is I can't dance. So it's very much a dream career. Yeah, that's sort of what I envision myself doing. I love musicals, though. I'm definitely a big musical fan. And I will try to bring them into my books from time to time. But I'm quite happy that I am in the career that I am in, because it is actually my dream job.
Wow. Well, I think your fans will completely agree that it's wonderful that you became an author. Speaking of fans, what is the most memorable fan letter that you've ever received?
So I have actually received a few notes. I'm going to be quite blunt here, but not inappropriate, about readers who have said they've had better sex after listening to a romance novel or reading a romance novel. And they're like, I thought Julie and Clay were such a sexy couple, or, you know, I thought Brett and Shannon were such a great couple. And I have to confess, I actually had a great night with my husband after. And I actually have some listeners who have told me that they've listened to certain scenes doing certain things.
Whoa.
That's impressive. Seriously impressed. But I actually like hearing that, because, look, I know I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm not a brain doctor. I'm not curing cancer. But my feeling is that I'm hopefully providing something that is both entertaining, but when it inspires somebody to get closer to the person they care about, that's a good thing. That's a healthy thing. You know, they're engaging in an activity that is good for them instead of something harmful. So I actually really like hearing that, because I feel like, okay, I've done something positive and productive and made their day a little better.
Great. And do you ever feel bashful about writing such steamy books?
I don't, actually. I mean, I'm at the point where I've written so many now that I can be sitting on my couch and, you know, it's sort of a dog. I have mostly lap dogs. I have a lap dog on each side, and my daughter will walk by right when I'm in the middle of writing a naughty scene or something. And you just kind of keep going. It becomes the job. And hopefully they are exciting for listeners, and certainly they can be exciting to write. But yeah, it's not something that I'm bashful about, because I'm so accustomed to it now.
And what is the first romance novel that you ever read?
Gone with the Wind.
Oh.
Absolutely love that. Read it many times when I was a girl, when I was growing up, and that was just so inspirational to me. I loved everything about it, and that's what really kind of got me started on reading romance. And I'm sure some people would say it's more of an epic story, which it is, but I think at its heart it's very much a romance. And then I started devouring Sydney Sheldon and Jackie Collins and Danielle Steele, which, you know, probably gives away my age somewhat, but that's okay. But I loved all of those romance writers. I remember reading Danielle Steele's The Ring, and it was just this wonderful story about a husband and wife were kind of separated, and then do they eventually come back together? And I just thought, I love this. I love this epic romance across time. And I've always loved watching romantic movies and romantic comedies. So I'm glad that all of that has brought me back here.
And when you're not writing or reading, what do you do to unwind?
I'm not a big relaxer, to be quite honest. I am a busy person. I like staying busy. I love working. I love writing. But it just spending time with my family is what I do when I'm not writing or running the business. I have two kids, a husband. Four dogs and three cats, and I like spending time with all of my pets and all of my family, and I am a huge fan of TV comedies. That's what I like to, like, when I totally unwind and kind of separate from work, that's what I like to do. I love the HBO comedies like Ballers and Veep and Vice Principals, and listeners who are probably familiar that I've mentioned them in past books. And that's why, because it's usually what I'm actually watching at the time. And I'm a big fan of lunch. I like to go out to lunch as much as I can. That's definitely a big sign of my relaxation.
And when you are writing, out of all the heroes that you've created, who is your favorite and why?
All of them, or whoever I'm writing at the time. It's so hard to pick because I think, and I know in some ways that might feel like a cop-out answer, but my feeling is if I'm not madly in love with the hero I'm writing at the particular moment when I'm writing him, then you're not going to fall in love with him. Then the listeners and the readers aren't going to fall in love with him. So every time I'm writing somebody, he feels like the best hero I've ever written. And the heroine feels like the one I relate to the most, because that's what keeps me writing every day. That's what keeps me going. I flip open the laptop. I'm like, oh, my God, I need to spend more time with Griffin. I need to spend more time with Cooper or whoever it is. And if I feel that way about him, hopefully that's a large part of what elicits that reaction from readers and listeners.
And what is something that people would be surprised to learn about you?
So I make my bed at hotels, and it always sort of surprises
me. Yeah.
That's the reaction I usually get. Like, seriously, you know, they have people who do that, Lauren. I know. I really don't like messes. I really don't like unmade beds. And I don't do a perfect job like the housekeeping staff will do. But I really can't stand looking at an unmade bed wherever I am. And I actually gave that trait to a heroine of mine in a novella, in my novella Stud Finder. The heroine shares that same feeling about unmade beds in hotel room. So, yeah, that's my little confession.
Wow. Well, thank you for this interview, Lauren, and thank you for this book. We hope that you listeners enjoyed hearing from Lauren Blakely. And to find out what she's working on next, you can visit her at laurenblakely.com.
This has been an Audible Original Publishing production of Wanderlust, written by Lauren Blakely. Performed by Grace Grant and Richard Armitage. Executive producers Elizabeth Scholar and Mike Charzik. Producer Kat Lambrix. Directed by Chelsea Pita and John Ainsworth. Edited by Mikhail Shurikov. Mixed and mastered by Brett Lubansky. Copyright 2017 by Lauren Blakely. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.